Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories that I'll be looking at in today's programme. Pope Benedict speaks about one of the Church's greatest ever thinkers, St. Augustine of Hippo, at his weekly general audience. The Apostolic Nuncio in Kenya comments on the chances for peace and reconciliation there, following the Pope's appeal for an end to the ethnic violence that erupted after disputed elections. And we hear from a Jesuit priest in Nairobi, who says the lack of a national identity has helped fuel ethnic and tribal divisions in his country. And finally, going green. We find out how a number of Benedictine monasteries in the US are trying to lessen their carbon footprint by installing wind turbines to generate electricity. One of the Church's greatest ever thinkers, St. Augustine of Hippo, the 4th century bishop, was the focus of Pope Benedict's catechesis at his weekly general audience. Emma McCarthy has this report.
A towering figure within the life of the Church, that's how Pope Benedict XVI introduced the figure of 4th century St. Augustine of Hippo to pilgrims gathered in the Paul VI Audience Hall this Wednesday.
The great intellectual heritage of antiquity found expression in Augustine's many writings, which then became a rich source of inspiration and teaching for centuries to come.
Pope Benedict told pilgrims that to find out more about this saint, they should turn to his writings.
Augustine's spiritual autobiography, The Confessions, tells the story of his Christian upbringing, his secular education, his decision to devote his life to the pursuit of truth, and his eventual abandonment of the faith. Attracted at first by Manichaean dualism, he gradually recovered the faith of his childhood, thanks to the prayers of his mother, St. Monica, and the brilliant teaching of St. Ambrose, then Bishop of Milan.
The Confessions, he said, recount Augustine's tormented interior journey, which led to his moral and intellectual conversion, culminating in his baptism by Ambrose.
Returning to Africa to lead a monastic life, Augustine became a priest and then the Bishop of Hippo. In his 30 years as bishop, he proved himself an exemplary pastor, an assiduous preacher, and an influential champion of the Catholic faith.
Such is the immense value of this great African saint that the Pope announced he will be dedicating his audiences exclusively to him for the coming weeks.
In coming weeks, we will turn our attention to the writings and the thought of this great doctor of the Church.
On a lighter note, as he was greeting English-speaking pilgrims to Rome, Pope Benedict XVI was treated to an impromptu rendition of the Ave Maria by a choir who had journeyed from North America.
I am pleased to welcome the English-speaking pilgrims present to this audience, especially the students group from Australia and the United States. I greet the group of deacons from the Archdiocese of Dubuque, and I thank the choir for the praise of God in song. Upon all of you, I invoke God's abundant blessings of joy and peace.
International mediation efforts are continuing in Kenya, where hundreds of people were killed and many more displaced in ethnic and tribal violence that erupted following disputed elections in December. The violence has waned in many areas, although a humanitarian crisis now looms over the poorest of the poor in the slums of the capital Nairobi and the country's rural highlands. Pope Benedict has called for an end to the violence and urged Kenya's politicians to resolve the conflict through dialogue and debate. In a letter sent through the Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, to the country's bishops, the Pope said he had followed the great tragedy in Kenya with deep sorrow and concern. He called on the nation's political leaders to embark resolutely on the path of peace and justice, since he said the country needs peace that is based on justice and brotherhood. The apostolic nuncio to Kenya is Archbishop Alan Paul Le Beaupin, who says he believes the will is there to work for peace and reconciliation.
What happened in just 1 week, of course, has been so terrible for many people. It was really a disaster, we can say. But it's not just a humanitarian disaster. It was a real national disaster. And I think the international community did the best they had to do. And I think because the Kenyans were really conscious of the disaster where they were going. So it's not, as I said, to my opinion, imposed, but probably it is what it was necessary. And after, of course, you need maybe facilitation, is what I will be saying. It's why I think it was very good, but, you know, has been in a short time because you had the goodwill. And not only goodwill, as we use the words usually, but the political will probably to go out.
I suppose there is a huge pressure, really, to resolve this crisis, and especially as it's looking at Kenya's reputation as a really one of the most vibrant democracies and most promising economies in Africa.
Yes, that it is also why I think the Kenyan peoples also wanted the leaders to find a way to go out. It's why it has not been so difficult to arrive where we are. It's not just to convince them. I think, you know, it was not a question to convince them. It is for the reason you presented. The economy of the country in 1 week has been already with some consequences. All the peoples on the both sides have been conscious of that. And their people who voted for them, they were asking in a way to create the good cooperation among them. Because we have to remember that the three candidates to the elections were working together for the elections of 2002. They won the election in 2002 together, and they have been working together at least for 3 years. So they know one another, and is why I believe it's good that they could go back maybe to think what they made before and what has to be done in the future. And I am very confident.
There's no doubt that the church has taken certainly a very strong viewpoint on the situation, on this idea of really consolidating peace and forging really reconciliation.
If you take what was in the letter of Cardinal Bertone, and what it was an appeal to the head of the politicians here in this country, in a way, I don't say they follow, but it was what the good sense. So it's why I believe many religious leaders and first the Holy Father were showing that way. And I think the people as adults decided to take that way. I now pray for them to be strong on their decision. But I think it was not a real decision imposed to them by the international community. It's imposed by the situation for the economy to stop what happened, because, of course, it's very dangerous to have this kind of confrontation based on ethnic or social realities. So it's why that also has been. The letter of Cardinal Bertone has been published in the two principal newspaper here and has been presented personally to the different leaders.
And certainly it's the idea of hope, isn't it? I mean, certainly the Pope talking in his encyclical Spes Salvi, this whole idea of hope, hopes for peace, hopes for forging reconciliation and the hopes for many
and
people that
justice,
this can be.
And justice,
indeed.
It was one, there's peace and justice. And that is what the people are expecting for the future.
That was the Apostolic Nuncio to Kenya, Alan Le Beaupin, talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kay. But what are some of the deeper reasons behind this massive wave of ethnic violence in a nation that until now was seen as one of Africa's most stable democracies? To find out more, my colleague Irene Lagan spoke to Father Elias Omundi, head of the Jesuit Hakamani Center in Nairobi.
The divide is clearly tribal and ethnic. The way it's been used, and in this country, it's an issue that has never been solved. I was on the Catholic radio on Saturday being interviewed there, and I was saying that we've managed to build a country, and people have envied Kenya as a strong economic center within this region of Africa and mediating for peace and making all this economic progress, but we've failed to build a nation. We've not been able to bring the 42 tribes together as a few other African, the first African presidents, like Julius Nyerere and Kwame Nkrumah and Kaunda in Zambia, did with their people. That let's build first and foremost the national identity. But in this country, we moved much more on the economic issues, but we ignored the very fundamental issues and never even put that within the constitution or put the structures that were meant to help all the regions be part of the country. And so these ethnic divides have been used. And I've always said that, you know, ethnicity has been politicized and the politicians have used it for their own gains. And also politics has been ethnicized in such a way that if you want majority behind you, then you go back to your regions and garner the votes within those regions. And we've seen this trend being used politically, being used within the economic policies and implementation. And so some regions within the country have felt marginalized by these kind of systems. And so I think the problem is much, much deeper. We cannot just call for a kind of a national identity without putting in structures to ensure that there's equal equity in economic distribution, for example. You don't expect people to feel part of the country when they're not involved in the social organization of the society, when they're not involved in the governance systems.
Now that the violence has come to an end, are people in the country resolved to overcome their differences? What is the outlook there? And another question, just to follow up on that, the Holy Father recently sent a letter to the Kenyan bishops and to the people of Kenya. What kind of an impact does the message of the Holy Father have for the people?
I think we still have to deal with the humanitarian crisis currently. Some of the people that I even called some of my friends, especially in the Rift Valley area, because that's the most affected part of the country, and some were telling me that they don't think they'll even want to go back to the Rift Valley. They've lost their land, they've lost their property. It's not the first time. It happened in 92 elections, it happened in 97 elections, but this time they've been hard hit because it was so fast and they hardly had even a chance to get some of their properties out. I would first of all look at the people who have been displaced. These are still hurting. They've lost their property. Some were really wealthy and they were doing very well, and now you're reduced to zero. These people will continue to feel the anger, the revenge in them, and they'll need to be helped in a process that will have to see justice being done. And if this thing was well planned, or the people that were involved ought to be arrested and brought to court, and then they need to get their land back. In other words, we need clear structures of security and citizen participation in the organization of the society in such a way that when we're talking of reconciliation, then it's the reconciliation that is supported by certain structures that will ensure security, structures that will ensure that I, as a person of a different ethnic community, can live in any part of this country without feeling threatened. So putting those structures in place. On the Pope's letter, I would say people have been so much overwhelmed by what's going on and all kinds of statements that have come up that I wouldn't be in a position even to assess the impact of such a letter. What we still remember is the bishop's statement and what the bishop said in terms of calming down the people and asking them to go back to their daily activities and to stop the violence and to help the needy. But many people are still raising justice issues that are not being addressed, and that people don't want to feel ransomed, you know, taken at ransom by calls for peace without calls for justice. And calls for justice, that there have been clear indication that these elections were certainly flawed and rigged, and that there has to be an amicable process towards that.
One final question, Father. Do you hold out hope that the mediation will actually help resolve some of these deeper issues, or will it just address really the political election issues?
The political settlement could take two or three options. The first one is to talk of a coalition government or government of national unity, where the opposition can also fail to be part of the government, which could be unfortunate, because then you'll have a very weak opposition, if at all there will be an opposition. But it will be positive in the sense that we could run this for a period like 1 year for a unity government to reconcile the country, to go around and call for peace and unity, and to address real serious issues of displacement and people who have unjustly kicked out of their land or their area, and also to call for a national identity. That will be very important, to use this as a transitional government. And then for a period of a year or so, then we move into fresh elections or rerun of the presidential elections in order to solve the issue. But in the meantime, during this period, I would like to see mediation process also call for long-term constitutional reforms, ensure a presidency that controlled under checks and balances, that will ensure that we don't fall back into this kind of situation 5 years to come in the next election.
That was Jesuit Father Elias Omundi speaking to my colleague Irene Lagan. As concern about the effects of climate change becomes more widespread, efforts by organisations and individuals to try to lessen their carbon footprint or raise awareness about the extent of the problem are multiplying. And the Vatican and Catholic Church at large are also playing their part in this global endeavour. In 2007, the Vatican hosted its first ever international conference on climate change, and it also announced plans to become the world's first carbon neutral state. Other green projects by the Vatican include a plan to install solar energy panels on the roof of the Paul VI auditorium, which is used for the papal general audiences. Pope Benedict has on a number of occasions urged Christians to take care of creation, saying lifestyle choices are damaging the environment and making the lives of poor people especially unbearable. In the US, a small number of Benedictine monasteries have been going green for a long time, and more religious orders are now joining the eco bandwagon by installing wind turbines to generate electricity on their properties. One of the pioneers in this regard is the Benedictine Sacred Heart Monastery, located at Richardson in the US state of North Dakota. In 1997, the monastery installed two wind turbines to combat escalating electricity bills and protect the environment. Sister Paula Larson is the business manager at the monastery, and she told me how at the time there were many who opposed this decision.
We faced a lot of opposition, and I felt like I was pushing a rope uphill, but it turns out that we are the first people in North Dakota to have a commercial-sized wind turbine. And because of the success of our project, the wind industry has exploded and is expanding in our state.
Now, you said you faced a lot of opposition. From whom and why?
Opposition from our electrical generation company, because they didn't think it would work. Opposition from other utilities. Opposition from our persons that provide the energy for our heat. We faced a lot of opposition, and I felt like I was pushing a rope uphill, but it turns out that we are the first people in North Dakota to have a commercial-sized wind turbine, and because of the success of our project, the wind industry has exploded and is expanding in our state.
Now, you said you faced a lot of opposition. From whom and why?
Opposition from our electrical generation company, because they didn't think it would work. Opposition from other utilities. Opposition from our persons that provide the energy for our heat.
What was the cost of the turbines and what have been the savings made in terms of lower electricity bills over the past 10 years?
The cost of the turbines in the initial phase was $120,000, and we thought if we could save 25% a year on our electric bill that we'd pay them off in 10 years, and we far exceeded that. Our lowest production has been 25%, but our highest production has been over 50% of our electricity.
So it's already more than paid for itself.
That is correct.
So if you had to work out what you've saved over the past 10 years, have you got a figure there?
I would say that it would be close to between $175,000 and $200,000.
In 2006, a school in Rhode Island run by Benedictine monks gave the green light to a project to construct a wind turbine for generating electricity. Brother Joseph Byron, one of the monks at the Portsmouth Abbey School, was the mastermind behind this project, and he told me more about how it got off the ground.
It was my idea and a fellow who works with me who's the director of operations. We run a prep school here, and costs were going through the roof, and people said we should be trying these kind of things, and so we decided just to go for it and see what we could come up with.
And did you face any opposition, or were people surprised at first by this decision?
Well, I guess people were surprised. One of the things in hindsight that we did right was that when we first started talking about this, I literally went door to door around the neighborhood and said, you know, people say we should be trying to do these things and we'd like to put one up and we know it's really big. What do you think? And so the neighbors were incredibly supportive of the whole thing, and so was the town. And that made a huge difference here.
Now, I know you've only had it in for a year, but have you got any idea what kind of savings you will make for the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, it's done incredibly well by us. We use about 2.6 million kilowatt hours a year for the school here and the monastery. And we saved about 40% of our total electric load by having the turbine up. So in the first year, when all was said and done, money we saved and money we earned from selling electricity, we earned about $200,000 into the school's budget last year. So if you just keep multiplying that year by year, and it'll do better as the price of electricity actually goes up. So it's done very well and it's been very popular.
Both these projects have clearly reaped long-term benefits in terms of lower electricity bills and reduced emissions of fossil fuels. But as both Sister Paula and Brother Joseph explain, there are also theological and ethical issues underpinning their decision to turn to wind energy.
God asks us to walk gently on the earth, and also in Scripture it says that the wind blows where it wills. So we feel that the wind is part of God's creation for us to use to help in his work, and that's kind of how we explain it.
From our perspective here, right specifically here, we live in a really beautiful piece of property, and we've always thought of ourselves as being the stewards of this really beautiful place. And in general, that applies, you know, on a broader range, that we're all custodians and stewards of the place we live in, and we should be trying to take care of it and not abusing it. And so we're kind of putting our money where our mouth is and says, okay, well, here's a way to at least make a step at that one.
So apart from the wind turbines, are there any other ways in which the monks in Rhode Island are trying to preserve the environment and lessen their carbon footprint? Brother Joseph again.
The biggest thing we're doing is, I mean, in general, around the whole place, we're trying to conserve energy as much as we can. We've done a big program of converting to compact fluorescent lights, putting high-efficiency boilers in, motion sensor switches, water-saving devices, you name it. We also, we just built a green dormitory for the school that has a big solar array for heat and hot water on the roof and all kinds of green things in it. So we're doing everything we can think of to try and do that.
Sister Paula believes that the Catholic Church is now doing a lot to promote greater awareness of environmental issues.
I think the Catholic Church is teaching on environment and supporting environmental efforts. It is greatly encouraged. And also, we have encouraged other Catholic facilities in our area to consider wind energy as a means of helping them to financially support themselves.
And, as Brother Joseph points out, we can all play our part in this endeavour to cut down on our carbon emissions.
The biggest thing that we all can do is just trying to conserve what we're using so that we're not kind of hogs and we're turning the lights off and we're trying to use as little electricity as we can and still do the right thing. So, yep, conservation is the biggest thing. And then if you've got space or you've got a big facility, then something like this or solar or geothermal, the other green energy sources should be looked into. They make sense from a financial point of view as well as from a green point of view.
And all the other monks, went along with this decision? There were no dissenters?
Well, I'm not sure that I would go quite that far. I was saying to folks in the town, my feeling was if I could convince my brethren to do this, I could probably convince anybody to do this. We tend to be a fairly conservative lot. And in fact, there's one funny story. One of the former abbot here, who's quite a funny guy, and in the course of this, he was not quite so keen about it. And somebody printed him up business cards that said MAP, and it was Monks Against Progress. And it was all rather tongue-in-cheek. But in the end, I think everybody's very happy that we've done this.
So are you now called the monks who've gone green?
So, joking apart, these two monasteries' green credentials are now firmly established. And as Sister Paula reveals, other religious orders are now following their example. And she is proud that her monastery was one of the first to go green.
Other Benedictines are beginning to do this. We have a monastery in Missouri that is working with a utility and is going to put up a wind turbine on their property. And we have a steady stream of tourists and students who come here for educational programs and to understand how the turbines work.
Do you feel in some ways that you were trailblazers? Because you were going green long before it became more mainstream, shall we say?
Yes. I feel that we were trailblazers, and we are recognized within our state, exactly as you state, as trailblazers.
That was Sister Paula Larson, business manager at the Benedictine Sacred Heart Monastery at Richardson in North Dakota. And you also heard the voice of Brother Joseph Byron, a Benedictine monk at the Portsmouth Abbey School in Rhode Island. That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.